Hey everybody, welcome to episode 127 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back, welcome aboard. I am coming to you from our apartment in Torremolinos in Malaga, southern Spain. As of 2 weeks ago, we were lucky and we found a great apartment in a good neighborhood for a super reasonable price, just a couple blocks from the beach. We've also finally been able to submit our visa, and hopefully within 2 or 3 weeks, we will find out that we are approved. Otherwise, we'll be getting thrown out of the country and be on the hook for a 10-month rental. So wish us continued luck. This is potentially the last episode of Season 6. I'm going to try to put out one more episode, a shorter episode, possibly a Go Gumbo episode. I'm going to try to stay on schedule and have it come out in 2 weeks, but no promises, as there are a lot of things going on in my life that I don't completely have control over at the moment. Today we have a fun episode for you. We have the return of Pamela Zulaylan. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you may remember her from the first season, episode 13, but she's also appeared in episodes 31 and 104. Her life has evolved a lot over the decades since she has appeared on the show. She is currently a guide, an outdoor educator, a llama mama, a ski patrol team member, a volunteer forest ranger, and the steward of an Angeles Forest cabin. And we recorded this shortly before Erica and I left Los Angeles for Spain, and we recorded this at Pamela's cabin in the woods in the Angeles Forest. So let's head now over to that cabin and talk about llama beans, backwoods cabins, wildfires, a topic that is very pertinent right now, pack animals, and what it was like to deal with a mountain lion attack. So let's go talk to Pamela Zulaylan.
My name is Pamela Zulaylan, and this is my third time on the Go Get Outside.
No, fourth.
Oh, that's right, the JMT. I forgot about the JMT one. So this is my fourth time, and I'm really grateful that Jason thinks I'm interesting enough to actually have me on again. But a little bit about me. I'm a guide and an outdoor educator. I'm a llama mama, and we're here at a cabin in the forest about a 2-mile hike in the Angeles National Forest, and this is my little piece of heaven, my home away from home, that I've named Whispering Pines. So
I think you and Alden Anderson are fighting for most appearances on the podcast. I'm not actually sure who's winning.
Oh, damn him.
I'm going to
come to Spain then.
Well, the funny thing is you both appear in that JMT episode. So
you both
have that one. You both appear in the solo backpacking episode. And then you both have individual episodes. He has 2 individual episodes.
Oh,
and this is your second individual episode. So you might be tied.
Oh, well, that's good. When I go see Alden in a couple weeks, because I'm like, Alden, I want to go see your dome. So I'll have to, arm wrestle it out.
All right. So when you first appeared on this show, I looked, it was episode 13.
I loved that it was episode 13. I was really stoked on that.
It was 2015. Mm-hmm. It came out, I think it was September of 2015, which means we probably recorded it in like June or summertime or something, which it is now June. So yeah. So in that case, nine years since we recorded that episode. I suspect that what we're going to talk about in this episode versus what we talked about in that episode and what your life looks like now versus then are going to be drastically different. Is that safe to say?
It's incredibly safe to say, and my life has evolved in such a beautiful way, and I manifested all of this crazy stuff that I believed I could have, and I knew that I wanted, but I'm sitting in a reality that is really pretty special. So it has changed a ton, but not really in the sense that I still spend a ton of time outdoors. I'm still teaching. I'm still backpacking. I'm still doing all of those things. There's just big elements of my life that are now really permanent fixtures that have kind of added to the fun of all of that.
I feel like a lot of what we talked about then, too, was like your early days outside, your extreme sports adventure days, street luge and skydiving and kind of those really adventure sports. And for people listening who haven't listened to our past episode, they should go listen to it because we talk about how you were in the X Games and how you used to pop up on MTV all the time. We talked about when you were on that game show where they had to figure out who you were.
Yes, to tell the truth. Yes.
That's right. So this was a part of your life where you were, for lack of a better term, maybe adrenaline junkie, right? That's what people would have probably called you then.
Yeah, people would have said that, definitely.
Yeah. So we talked a lot about that, and then we talked about where you were then in life, and then now we're 9 years after that, hanging out at your cabin in the forest.
Yes.
So let's talk about...
It's such a weird transition 25 years later to now, for sure.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about the progression of a human in the outdoor space and the adventure sports space. And what that looks like as you age and become wiser and change your interest in life.
Whew. Well, all I'm going to say is my life has been a beautiful wild ride. And every chapter of it has kind of pushed me to that next chapter where I am now. So even, you know, having had the opportunity when I was an extreme sports athlete to travel all over the world, it allowed me to see places and do things and experience things in such a different way. The outdoors have always been a huge part of that. So even when I was traveling then, I was still going and, you know, spending as much time in our natural wild spaces. At home, that was always a big part of me. Even when I was younger, even pre all of that, as a youth, you know, I'd go outside and I would stare at the sky at night when I couldn't sleep. I'd just sneak out the window, you know, of my bedroom, and I would enjoy the wild spaces. So nature has been a huge part of my evolution, a huge core part of who I am. And it's been something that I can't imagine not having be a part of my world because it's shaped so much about my world.
Let's hit a few of the things that we would have talked about in the past episode just to bring everyone up to speed. So where was it that you grew up?
I grew up in the LA County area. So I actually grew up in Monrovia, California. I grew up near Monrovia Canyon Park. So my parents' house was up in the foothills. The Angeles National Forest was my backyard. I was always climbing trees. I was always in the creeks. I was always sort of in this environment. So I had the beauty of being so close to nature, but then also the beauty of sort of a very big urban setting and the influences of, you know, more of a city landscape too.
That's one of the things when I first moved to LA that I didn't foresee coming. And as much as people hate on LA and complain about LA, and there are valid reasons to love it and valid reasons to hate it, that is one of the things about it that isn't common, or at least isn't always true about a lot of large cities, is it really is a place where you've got that huge city lifestyle, but you also have, if you're aware of it and if you're open to it, this amazing access to an outdoor lifestyle. It's not that hard to balance the two out here.
It's not. And it's so funny because I personally think of LA as a mountain town. Like, think about all of those epic landscaped pictures you see of downtown Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. They're always with the background of the Angeles National Forest, usually snow-capped. And we have all of that within an hour of sort of the downtown area. You have access to some of the best trails in the area, some of the highest peaks in the area. And so in my mind, LA really is a mountain town, even though you've got the Hollywood, you've got the Rodeo Drives, you've got the Santa Monica, you know, Pier, you've got Venice Beach, but it's still like we are surrounded by just epic nature, either coastally or mountain-wise.
I'm curious, because I think for both of us growing up, there was very much this idea of LA as Hollywood, like maybe Malibu, rich celebrity people, entertainment industry. I wonder if that's still how the general public or younger people see that. Because people of our age, when they hear Los Angeles, they just think Hollywood. They immediately think movie industry, celebrities. I wonder if that's still true for young people, because so much of that industry has moved all over the globe now, and I wonder if there's a different concept of Los Angeles. We should figure this out.
I'm going to say yes to the point that you said is the Hollywood industry is now really more of a global industry. Mm-hmm. It's not so set here. I think the Hollywood industry is what you think of, like Hollywood and Vine and the Hollywood Walk of Fame and things that are very touristy. But yes, there are productions that still happen around even my local neighborhood, but there's a big, huge film industry in like Budapest, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a place that is easier for Hollywood to do because of, you know, LA and taxes and things like that.
So what keeps you in Los Angeles? Because you are at a point where you could probably be anywhere.
I am at a point that I could probably be anywhere, but now what actually keeps me in town is this cabin. So I purchased this cabin a few years ago. It's one of the land lease cabins. So I am in the Chantry Flats area within the Angeles National Forest. It's a completely off-grid cabin. Originally, there were about 365 cabins in this canyon specifically. Now there are less than 60. There are about 55-ish cabins that exist, and being able to have access to this cabin is what actually has kept me in LA, because I have my house, but then I have this cabin, and this cabin is sort of my grounding point and my sanity. And when I need to get away from being in the city, I come here. So I think if I didn't have this, it would be so much easier for me to actually just say, wow, why am I in LA? I grew up in LA, so I have a love for the city. Mm-hmm. And I really have a love for our museum culture, and I have a love for our nightlife, and I have a love for our theater, and like LA is really rich in all of those experiences. But the history of our mountains is really a phenomenal history. We have what's known as the Great Hiking Era. We had things like the Great Incline, Castle Canyon, the White Hotel in the Clouds, all of those which are hiking relics now you can get to. We have, you know, this canyon itself that had four very specific hike-in camps where people would hike in specifically from the city to spend time in the canyon to have time in nature. So there is really a hiking culture within this community that people might not be aware of, but the history is here. I mean, we have old mining communities within, you know, this natural range. So to me, that juxtaposition of being in the city, and then you look at this incredible range of mountain. I mean, we have peaks that are some of the highest peaks in this range. They're, you know, within a hiking distance even from where I'm at. Mm-hmm. So it's a beautiful space. And I think there's so much exploration to be done within your local area that you don't really need to go far. You just need to discover what's actually here.
So like you said, we're a little north of Arcadia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then basically drive up to the Chantry Flats area. And mm-hmm. then we hiked roughly an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at this cabin. Let's talk about the particulars, because this is a unique setup. So tell us all the particulars. What does this cabin look like? What's the size of it? Where exactly in the canyon? Not like precise location, but
I can give you the Latin longitude.
Yeah,
I do
please,
have. I can actually
give you
that.
If you could please, give it down to the second or whatever. But if you could just kind of describe the location of where we are, but then the particulars of what this cabin is and how it is that you're allowed to own it, because it's technically in National Forest land, correct?
Yes. So back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, up until 1936, the last cabin, the land grab and cabin claim was actually built in 1936. So from about 1885 to about 1935-ish, 36, anyone was allowed to come in and build on this land. It was before they started putting particulars on what you could and couldn't do, that you could do a land grab, build a cabin, and essentially have a cabin here. And then
to do a land grab, was it literally, hey, if I'm there first, I can lay claim
to
it?
Yes, if I'm here first, I can build a cabin on the land. You couldn't own the land. You could lease the land through the National Forest, and at the time, they had 99-year leases. So technically, I could pass my cabin on. Recently, that's been changed to a 20-year land lease. So my lease and all of the National Forest cabins in the United States, the lease actually runs out in 2028, and then they'll do another 20-year lease. But in that time, I mean, I think what makes these cabins so unique and so particular is, you know, just the person who decided they were going to build a cabin, built a cabin. So it was ever, however they wanted to build it, whether it was some of the cabins are all just stonework and masonry work. Some of them, my cabin happens to be just all wood, you know, so they're all unique and all very different. Some are really, really rustic with these grand stone fireplaces that you walk into, and that's sort of the center set of the room. Some of them are just some big room. Some of them are two stories. Some of them, you know, are multiple little cabins as one big cabin unit. So they're super, super unique. My cabin is one of the older cabins. So it was built in 1932. So it's a little bit, I'm going to say, more modern. None of the cabins...
it's more modern.
It's more modern.
Only 90 years old.
Yeah. You know, none of them have electricity. Most of them do have some sort of well access where they do have some well water. I am close to the Winter Creek, so I can literally pull water from the creek and filter that. I'm one of the cabins that does have a shower, does have a flushing toilet, and does have running sink water. However, in the Bobcat fires, my water tank did burn down, so I am pulling water out of the creek right now.
That is definitely an ironic statement. My water tank burned down.
So a couple ridge lines up, about a quarter mile up the trail, there's literally, we have piped in from a natural spring that always runs. So I'm in a little group of four cabins, and we all shared one particular 700-gallon water tank. And then from that water tank, all of the piping went to each separate cabin. So all of our water came off of that water tank out of that spring. And the water tank burned down. And then after we had the series of floods that came in through the canyon, then that whole water system got flooded out. So it's about rebuilding that pool and that whole essentially quarter miles worth of piping to repipe all of the cabins, and then bringing in another very large water tank in on foot. So that will happen in the next couple years. I've been wrangling my neighbors to, like, let's do this. Let's get a water tank and let's get some water running.
Right.
But for now, as an avid backpacker, you know, I think that's kind of part of the charm. It just adds to the chores that we do. You know, I call them chores because it's really, I'm still required by this permit to have a clear-cut range, you know, to come and sweep and rake, clear the rooftops off. We will get cited if a ranger will do random checks a couple times a year. If things aren't up to code to what we're required by our permits, you will get a citation. You will get a notice, and they'll say, hey, you know, you need to fix X, Y, and Z. This needs to be done. Because obviously their goal is that these cabins, you know, that we keep a clear cut. I mean, that's the reason why this cabin didn't burn down, is because there was that 40-foot range around. If you look at the trees, we didn't actually walk around the property, and I didn't show you where the burn line was, but, you know, we have just this beautiful tree right behind you, Jason. That's one of my favorite relics of the fire. It's just mangled and tweaked.
Oh, yeah. Not
and
very far
beautiful,
away.
And it's, you know, that's 40 feet away, and that tree was on fire. So, and then there's a tree on the other side that was 10 feet away that caught fire, and thankfully it fell away from the cabin. So all of those requirements and clear cutting and those chores essentially are what keeps these cabins standing in case of a natural emergency like that occurs.
Yeah, and as we talked about earlier, you have to walk in. There's no driving here. So anything that you need here, you have to find a way to get it in on foot or through pack animal or something like that. Correct?
Yes, and that is what makes these really particularly special. I've seen old photographs where there are mules pulling stand-up pianos. I mean, I have this huge old...
I want to see a pipe organ.
Yeah, it's crazy, you know, and my cabin's only a couple miles. I mean, there are some cabins that are five miles in, and they, you know, like my neighbors, they've got an old bathtub with the clawfoot. Yes, with the clawfoot bathtubs. I mean, those things those are very, very heavy. I've got, you know, I can't even imagine how they got my stove in here. I mean, that thing when I was redoing the restoration on it, I couldn't lift it. I had to drag it, and it was just fiercely heavy. So I've got a couch bed, you know, like how on earth did they get that in here? Like, I'm only just imagining them just not only bringing in the lumber, but then bringing in the cabinetry, bringing in the couch, bringing in the mattresses, bringing in the beds, because mules can only carry 120 pounds, and that couch is not mule That's not...
Not mule ready.
Yeah, not mule ready.
It's interesting because it's probably really beneficial in a lot of ways, because anything you put in this cabin, you have to really want to have in this cabin. So this concept of, I'm just going to go shopping and buy crap I don't need and fill up my cabin, not likely to occur.
No, it's you know, I am very mindful to what I have brought in, because I want it to reflect on my having a better experience here. So when I get here, this is really sort of my space to just sort of find myself again. You know, when life kind of gets really crazy and tricky and everything gets very overwhelming with technology and you've got a lot going on, I'll call it in the real world. When I walk in here, it is like I've just transported myself someplace differently. Just the watching the sunrise, watching the sunset, listening to the creek, hearing the sound of the birds, seeing deer walk by, seeing bears, seeing mountain lions.
Right. That's why you're here, not to watch your big screen TV.
This cabin is completely off-grid, so there's no electricity, candlelight. I do have a little Goal Zero solar panel, and I have a Goal Zero battery pack, so I do have some electricity, but that's the beauty of it. You know, it's time for me to read, time for me to paint, time for me to do kind of creative art projects, time for me to just sort of not be distracted by the things that are really time-consuming and not beneficial in our day. Like, I just think of social media as that. You know, I mean, there's some beautiful things about social media, but there are a lot of, it's a huge time suck. So when I get here, I don't have any distractions. When I'm here with friends, we connect on such a level because we have nothing else but each other. Or, you know, just take a nap or go by the creek and, you know, do a swim or a dip. And so I have my best conversations with friends, and I get to know people better in places like this because we're not surrounded by distraction. I'm not going to get something on my phone that's going to vibrate. And oddly, my phone is here, and I'm only, you know, I'm just laughing because I'm like, you know, like this is just sort of this
paperweight.
It's a brick. You know,
until they get internet in here.
Exactly, which I don't. I will never get internet. I will not.
That's okay. There'll be cell signal eventually.
It's not what I want. It's a really beautiful thing. And I think this is just an extension off of me going backpacking. You know, so I do still backpack, but I spend 2 to 3 days a week here. You know, I'll spend an overnight and then like one just a day here. So I'm here about 3 days a week when my schedule allows for it. And I can't imagine my life any other way. That hike in is sort of that detoxing process of just walking in, and I can just feel like the weight of whatever is ailing me mentally, emotionally, work-wise. I just feel it lifting. I get here and I'm a very different person when I get here. And then when I walk out after being here for a day or two, or even just maybe an afternoon, like I have so much more clarity in my mind because I just have none of these distractions and none of this heaviness that we are always totally glued to when we think of that immediate access mm-hmm. to everything that we have.
Let's talk about the rules here, because like you were telling me, you can't own the property, but you can own the structure, and you're not allowed to live here year round. So let's talk about those rules and how those work and what that looks like.
So by owning one of these cabins, you own the cabin and then you lease the land. So with that being said, they're not full-time residents. So I cannot live here full-time, which, I mean, that would be really, it'd be very difficult. even though I do have some amenities right now, I don't. I'm pulling everything from the creek, but, you know, it would be doing everything by hand, everything candle lit. So I can be here part of the time, but not full-time. So in order for me to even be able to have the permit transferred into my name after I did purchase the cabin, like the amount of paperwork that I had to show that I actually had a real resident, a primary resident, was pretty phenomenal. You know, they did require to see quite a bit of paperwork to prove that I wasn't in fact going to be living in this cabin full time, that I did in fact have another full time residence. And my mail goes there, my bills, you know, my anything cabin related goes there, you know, anything I need to know through the Forestry Service, they mail it to me there, you know, my primary residence. You can own the cabin, you lease the land, but yet I'm still a steward to the land. So even though I don't own the land around me, I protect this land and I take this space very, very seriously. You know, everything that I see around me, I take responsibility on because I really believe in stewardship. I'm even just someone who has this cabin temporarily. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to have this forever.
Right.
And at some point, it's going to be passing it on to that person that's going to be another steward. Like, I'm essentially just caretaker to this cabin while I'm here. It's just to keep it standing another 100 years. It's to, you know, keep it repaired. It's in a very wild space. So, you know, there was a big lizard when we got here. We weren't sure right. if it was a snake or a lizard. Yeah. We just saw the tail slithering away. Mm. So, you know, I do get mice regularly if I'm not here for a couple weeks. Like, the mice are very apparent that they've said, oh, let's take over the place. So, you know, it is about really taking care of this cabin. And I feel very fortunate about that.
Right.
You know, I feel very honored and I feel very, very lucky. When I looked at some of the cabins, not every cabin owner will sell the cabin to the person that's looking at it. They really kind of get a feel for that person because they want to make sure that the right person is going to get the cabin, because we have such an incredible sense of ownership to this space as far as just taking care of it and making sure, you know, about leave no trace ethics, about really keeping it wild, about honoring and protecting these wild spaces, that it's not every person that is right for these cabins, you know. And I know that seems really weird, and I don't even think I would have been right for these cabins 20 years ago.
Right.
So I can say that from my own youth and my own experience and my own evolution as a person, that even though I would hike by these in my youth because I grew up in this area and I always wanted one of these cabins, 20 years ago I wouldn't have been in the right space mm-hmm. to have the knowledge I have and have this grasp and understanding of what an honor and what the stewardship of this cabin really means.
Right, because like you said, it's a privilege and a responsibility to be one of the owners.
It really, yeah. really is. Gosh, and I don't take that lightly. You know, I do come in and I'm always trimming things when I get here and raking things and clear cutting things. And I did actually get a letter in the mail from the Forestry Service, and they reminded all of the cabin owners of what the clear cutting is. And I was like, okay, they're going to be really honest this year if they're sending us a reminder to show us what that clear cutting mm-hmm. distance is. So, you know, I've let some things grow because I do want those wildflowers to reseed. I want to pull them once they seed so I can sprinkle them further away, and I've let some of the grasses stay. Like, I've got a lot of miner's lettuce that have come back within that 40-foot zone, but I'm like, well, my llamas are the trails in another 6 or 8 weeks. The trail will be livestock ready. I mean, we can literally see where the trail is being repaired right now. Mm-hmm. We've got the legacy crew out today doing trail work on some of the tougher parts of the trail to
That's
get
right.
it.
We got to climb over some of the fallen trees that they're trying to remove.
You know, I've left things, even though I know they need to be clear cut out, because I'm like, okay, I'm waiting for things to seed and collecting all of the seeds. So when I do that clear cutting, I'm at least reseeding all of that stuff at other space.
When you do the clear cut, what do you do with the cutting scraps? Is this sort of thing where you burn it, or do you have to hike it out?
Nope, I just sprinkle it further away.
Oh,
so I
okay.
just have to have like a really clear space. So even all of the oak leaves, I need to actually clear that all of that out. So I need to have it be on ground, and there's a 40-foot space. So I have to have a complete clear cut 40-foot space. I have to make sure the roofs are sweeped. And then anything beyond that, because of the fires, I've got so many down trees that I'm taking it upon myself to clear cut all of that out, to cut that up and save it as firewood. But all of that is really burnable kindling. If we ever did have, you know, another fire burn through here, at least that next layer of debris or brush or whatnot that is just, you know, volatile as fuel essentially mm-hmm. has been cleared out as well. But I leave the green growth and all of that, because that's what you want to see.
So let's talk about the acquisition of this place, because it's not the sort of thing you're just going to easily stumble upon online or in a real estate agent's office. What did that look like? How do you become aware of the availability? And then what's that process like where you come out and see these cabins and then choose a cabin and then try to become the new owner of the cabin? What did that look like?
This is such a unique process, because very, very rarely do these cabins actually become available where they would be, like through a real estate agent. I remember, you know, I've always just kept my eye on the pricing of the cabins, and kind of I've always just had a curious awareness, even though I knew at the time it just wasn't quite a right thing for me. So I have seen them where there have been literally a real estate agent, you know, sort of down the hill in the urban setting that would post some of these cabins.
Those real estate agents must hate trying to sell
these. They have to. Because I am a volunteer forest ranger, you know, I do come in and I do am part of the volunteer forestry service rangers. You know, I've come in, I pick up trash, I do trail work, things like that. I'm really aware of, you know, I know a lot of the cabin owners. For a while, my llamas were up at the Chantry Flats pack station and the upper stables. So I'm really connected with the community. So it was really easy for me when I was absolutely 100% like, I feel this in my gut. Now is the time. I am so ready to buy a cabin. It was very easy for me to know who to ask and just say, hey, keep your ears to the ground. And it was one of these things that I literally manifested, because every, seriously, it sounds so silly. Like, I know, you know, the law of attraction or manifestation or whatever, I might be getting a little
hip. Sacred.
Yeah, the sacred. Yeah, exactly. The secret. But every time I would hike, I'm in the Winter Creek loop. So I'm in Lower Winter Creek. So I'm right outside of Hoagie's Camp. And every time, this was a loop that I would always hike with my llamas, because it was a quick 5 mile loop. And it was just, you know, take a couple hours. I'd get them. We'd get ourselves out. We'd both take dips in the creek. You know, they'd get their dip. I'd get my dip. And then, you know, we'd do our loop. But I would always walk in. I would say, this is where I want my cabin. I want my cabin in this area, because it just felt right. It was a little bit off the beaten track. It wasn't, you know, through the main center of the canyon where most people go and where there's more cabin owners, and where I just knew, I said, it feels right. It's off the beaten track. It's a little, you know, a little more remote. You're not going to see as many people coming through here. So it'll really appeal to that kind of quiet side when I think of going to nature and being in nature, of, you know, having it just be more natural. And so I did manifest this for a while. And then when I was ready, I was just like, now's the time. I'm totally ready to get my cabin. I literally asked a couple of the cabin owners, and 24 hours later, the woman who was selling this cabin contacted me. And she says, hey, I understand that you're looking for a cabin. And then there was also another cabin in the main canyon that I knew the owner well. She's also a volunteer ranger. And she said, oh, I'm also selling my cabin too, if you want to take a look. So with the owner of this particular cabin, I hiked in with her. She opened it up. You know, she gave me the grand tour, told me all about the cabin, and we spent an afternoon. You know, it's a 2 mile hike in, so you get to, it's not a silent hike. You know, you're taking that time to kind of get to know the person mm-hmm. that potentially might be buying your cabin, to see, you know, what they're all about, if they feel like they're going to be a good steward to the land and a good steward to the cabin, you know.
If they know how to cross a stream.
If they know how to cross a stream, if they really know, you know, all of that. We got to know each other. We just immediately clicked right away. I looked at the cabin. It was one of those things where I was like, gosh, I really want to come back so I could really look at the cabin, because I didn't want to be that looky-loo with her here and start opening all the cupboards and doors and looking under things and seeing what, you know, like, I didn't want to be that. I was trying to be really mindful and still honor her space, because this was still her cabin. And then on our way out, she says, well, let me give you the keys, and why don't you just spend a couple days in the cabin on your own and tell me what you think, and then we'll reconnect in a month.
That's a pretty cool situation.
It was really cool. Then she also said, I looked you up, because by the time I contacted her, there was a 2 week time before we actually hiked in. So she really did, you know, and I sort of sent her my Chantry Flats resume of, like, you know, how I know everybody. And these are the people I know. I know the ranger, Kevin, and I, you know, I know Deb at the pack station, and my llamas, you know, are up here, you know, used to be up here. And so I kind of gave her my resume. I'm like, you know, talk to these people. They really know my integrity and they know who I am. And so when we were hiking in, she literally said, everyone had great things to say about you. They really felt you would really be a good steward to this cabin. And so that was the reason. It was because she really also did kind of look to see, is this the right person for this cabin? Because there's such a huge responsibility to these cabins. And when I say that, I don't mean it in an exclusive way. And I really hope that I don't come across in that way. But it is kind of, like I said, my younger self even though I always wanted one of these, wouldn't have been ready for this cabin. It wouldn't have been the time or space or the right place, even though I knew I wanted it. So I don't say that from an exclusive standpoint. I say that because it's such a privilege to have one of these cabins that it is really important that the person is ready for the responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so I hope I didn't come off saying that it's not an elite thing at all. I mean, anyone who's ever been to my cabin with me once the canyon opens, because we're still closure from the Bobcat fire, if I know that they've been here and I know that they have great integrity, if they want to come up without me, they're welcome to come up without me, because again, I know that they're going to be good stewards to the canyon and to the cabin. So let me circle back to your question. Mm-hmm. I then hiked in a couple times and really sat with the cabin, and let me just give you a visual on the cabin. So it's a 572 square foot sort of L-shaped cabin. It's got sort of the main room, we'll call it the great room, and it's got kitchen cabinets, it's got a table in it, and it's got a really old, awesome 1970s plaid, thick, kind of weird synthetic fold-out couch bed. Like, it's one of those things you're like, this is so 1970s. It's like ugly cool. So it's grown on me, and I really love it. And then it has a bedroom. It has a queen and then two twins. So the cabin can, you know, potentially sleep 4 to 6 people, depending on if there's couples or not. And, you know, so I really just spent time sort of sitting in the cabin. And again, I know this seems really hippy-dippy, but I kind of wanted to just get...
You sat with crystals around you?
I did. I sat with crystals. I burned my sage to get any spirits out. You know, I really just wanted to sit and see if this felt like the right cabin for me. I was very intent on wanting to make sure that I got a cabin that felt right to me, not because one was available. I did look at another cabin. Like I had mentioned, there were two immediately that I looked at within a week of each other. And the other cabin didn't feel like the right cabin for me. Like I really spent that time in it and I really did walk around it. And, you know, by the time you drive up here, park, hike in, you're committed to a time frame. So, you know, you do spend quite a bit of time. It's not an easy thing to do. I did spend time. And then this cabin, I still was a little unsure. I was like, oh, I'm not sure, you know. And then I was going to tell her no. She, when we met again after I had her keys for 2 weeks, I was going to tell her no. And then she told me that she really felt that I would be the right person for this cabin. She felt that all the pricing of the cabins were getting so unaffordable that she said someone like you should have a cabin. And she knew, like, I had talked to her and told her what my budget was. And she wanted more than what my budget was. And I was trying to figure out how I could get that. And part of my no was like, gosh, that's outreaching my budget. I know I could get that money. I know I could figure the difference out. And part of it was like, I'm not sure, doesn't feel right. So I had two things pulling at me, because part of it was a little bit budgetary and part of it was just, gosh, I don't know if this feels like the right cabin for me, even though it really was everything in the place that I wanted to. I think it was more the pull of the budget that was sort of going to be my reason for telling her no.
And you told me earlier, you cannot get a home loan on these. So you either need to acquire some other type of loan or have the cash on hand to pay for it.
Yeah. So these are cash buy cabins, which was a lot of, you know, I was like, I have this much cash that I'm willing to take out of my retirement fund. Mm-hmm. Because to me, this is something that will benefit my overall health in the next 20 years is being out here and having this cabin and doing all this hard work and being in nature. So there was a jump in the budget that I was just like, yeah, I have to figure that out. I have to see if that makes sense. And if it's a smart thing for me to do budgetary from where I was. And when I met back with the owner and she just started talking to me and she says, you know, Pamela, you know, I was really thinking very heavily on this and I just feel you would be such a good steward to this cabin. And that is really what this cabin needs, because they need a lot of work. And I know that you are just so passionate. And I know that with your outdoor education and with everything that you know and how passionate you are and with your volunteerism and with your love for this canyon and your understanding and knowledge of the history of the canyon and the great hiking era and, you know, everything that you know, like, I really feel like you are right for this cabin. She said, so I'm going to sell it to you within your budget, with what your budget was. I kid you not, I just started crying because I just couldn't believe that something that for the entirety of my adult that I really, really want, and I might actually start crying right now, for the entirety of my adult that it was actually happening,
right.
That this beautiful human, and I literally just started crying, and I looked at her and she grabbed my hand and I grabbed her hand and I said, "Can I hug you?" And she says, "Yes, you can hug me." And we hugged and I was crying and then she was crying.
So the very standard, usual house buying experience.
Oh my God, completely. You know, the standard house buying experience. So that is essentially how I ended up having this cabin. It was going to be a no. You know, I was literally going to tell her no because it was exceeding my budget. She just saw me. Like, she literally just saw the person that I was, our conversation in, you know, the time we spent just sitting out, when we probably spent 4 hours together just sitting where we're sitting now, just looking out at this view, and she's telling me stories and I'm sharing stories, you know, and it was all about this canyon, like our shared stories of this canyon and our shared love for this canyon. Yeah, so it was just a beautiful experience, and like, we're friends still. Like, any restoration I've done, you know, I send her a picture and she's like, "Oh my God, you were the right decision. I'm so glad you have the cabin." So it's, you know, I have a friend now. She's since moved to Colorado with her kid, you know, to be with her young adult children. But, you know, I just feel very fortunate to just be a part of this. And this is such a special place. And, you know, having this cabin just means such an immense amount to me because of just that experience.
So when you acquire it, there's work that needs to be done to it. And as you told me on the hike up, very shortly after you acquired it, there was a very large fire in the area. So let's talk about those two things, what the work that needed to go into it once you got it, but then also how it has all been impacted by this fire.
So the Bobcat Fire in September 2020 burned through this area, and it burned 200,000 acres. My cabin is just below the Mount Wilson Observatories, and because they were trying to protect the observatories, I think it was a huge help in the way that they were trying to detour and do drops. So I think this area, the region of the canyon, we got very, very lucky. My neighbor Jack's cabin, and I remember Jack's cabin. I would always hike by his cabin. He would come in every Tuesday, and he does landscaping, so he had beautiful plants always around his cabin, and I have a visual of his cabin, like from all the years I would hike in here. His cabin burned down, so a cabin below me burnt down. I mean, there's five trees that are burned around within 20 feet, in one case 10 feet of my cabin. So the water tank burned down, but this cabin did not burn down. My neighbors, there's four other cabins here, they didn't burn down either. So it was just the way we were so lucky that it was a very slow-moving fire, because it was what we call a fuel-burning fire, where there was no wind, so it wasn't the wind that was pushing it to move more rapidly. It was moving as it was getting something that it could burn. It would burn that tree or that shrub or those grasses. Those things would fall, and then it would sort of move that way. So it moved where there was fuel. So where there wasn't fuel, it couldn't burn, which is the reason why the Forestry Service has such an advocacy. Like, you absolutely, as part of the permit, you have to do this clear cutting on it. So the cabin was one that didn't burn down. We lost 17 cabins to the fire, and I think that is such a great loss because of the history of this canyon, and my God, that's its own other show. You know, the Great Hiking Era, just Google it, the Chantry Flats Great Hiking Era. I have a whole book on it. Again, you know, now it makes the cabins that are standing even more precious because there's 17 less.
Yeah, and then as you said, even after the fire, the things that survived the fire then had to contend with
flash flooding
and
you know, the environmental changes, because there's nothing holding the hillsides up. And then we had 2 years of incredible rains that we hadn't seen after all this drought. Hillsides are sliding down, trees are falling. The whole environment of the canyon has changed. Every time you come in, still, even this far after, you know, almost 4 years after the fires, trees are still falling. You know, you're still seeing ecosystems change. Everything went down to just being, with the rain, just sort of down to the rocks. And then now you're seeing life again with shrubs and flowers and small growth bushes are coming back, but we're still losing trees. We're still losing those trees that finally it was just too much from a drought perspective, and they are falling.
As unfortunate too as like the losses are, there's also an opportunity here that you get to watch firsthand how nature deals with fire and floods and acts of God, as they're referred to, and then adjust to that. You wouldn't get that experience back at your other home in the front country.
No, and you know, it's funny. I understand from a backpacker and a hiker and having all of these years in the backcountry what a forest fire could do, but I have never firsthand seen the devastation, but then with that, the beauty within that devastation and just how small pops of life or the way animals come in and are different to the environment or the way you'll see clusters of wildflowers come back. The year following, so 2021, we had the most incredible wildflowers that I had ever seen ever in this canyon. You know, that's still happening on a different level, even though things have since washed out. The flowers are coming back, and they're coming back differently. Just seeing the wildlife, seeing no wildlife, to seeing bears starting to begin to be able to forage naturally again with trees downing, and the way the insects start burrowing and they start breaking down sort of all of that environment to recreate the topsoil that was lost. So it's a really beautiful thing, as hard as it's been to come in and hike into the canyon, because you're hiking over debris piles. There are no trails. It really, the first time I came in after all of these rains, it took me 2.5 hours to do essentially a 50-minute hike. The landscape was devastated and it had changed. But to see just the beauty and the growth and the recovery, it reminds you just how absolutely incredible nature is, to be able to see all that, just how resilient animals can be. You know, seeing bears that you see regularly, and I can say this because we have one bear that we've named Peggy because her rear right leg, her knee is fused, so we can identify her because she has like a little peg leg. So 2 years ago she had one cub, this year she's had three. So you can just see this life of these bears that, you know, are beginning to come back and forage again naturally, and just the infrastructure of the deer coming back in. I mean, there was a while where there was just nothing. Like, we were, you know, we were hardly seeing any animals because there was nothing here for them. And so to see the growth come back and to see all the wildlife come back, it's been beautiful and it's been such a privilege. And that being said, it's also been very dangerous. So I do come in at my own risk. You know, the canyons are closed for a reason after wildfires. So it's not because we don't want people here. It's because knowing that anything can happen at any time. And I do have a story, actually, of something very, very scary that happened. Pretty wild that I was just like, really bad, Pamela. This canyon is closed for a reason. It's closed for recovery. It's closed because hillsides are changing. It's closed because there are no trails. You know, so this is the first year where trails have been able to be reestablished. And so we're starting to see that. So these closures aren't happening to keep people out. They're happening for safety and because it's constantly changing and they just can't let people in for safety reasons. It's just, it's not safe. So I do come in at my own risk every time, and, you know, anything can happen. And I know that any, you know, I do know that. I always carry a location beacon. I always let the ranger know when I'm coming in, just in case. Hey, if you see my car here for more than a day, something's going on, you know, like, just so you know, I'm not planning on being here for a week. So if my car's there for a week, there's a problem. So I do let people know when I'm in and when I'm out, you know, just for safety, because I am coming in and there's no one else here. Although surprisingly, you'd be surprised how many canyon owners I see, cabin owners I see when I hike into the canyon. So I'm like, oh my God, I'm like, for a closed canyon and for how few we are, there's quite a bit of activity of us, you know, doing the works on our cabins and, you know, doing trail work and making sure that it's accessible.
You just ran right past scary story.
Oh gosh.
So are you going to share this story?
I'm going to share this story because as an outdoor educator and a guide, there are certain things that I always know, and there are certain things that I always impress upon my students. And one is always preparedness. One is, which means checking the weather. Like I had mentioned, letting, you know, I let the ranger know when I'm going to be here, what my kind of plan of action is, because, you know, everything is changing and anything can happen. It was one of those days where I was in the process of redoing the wood burning stove, and I had wood supplies, I had concrete, I had a bunch of stuff in my trunk. I got off work early. It was a summer day, and I looked at the sky and I'm like, it's a perfect bluebird day. Darn it, I have 6 hours of daylight before the sun sets. I can hike into the cabin for an, you know, take that hour and a half hike in, drop off some supplies that I need for this restoration project I'm specifically working on, and then I can hike out. So because it was so spontaneous, I didn't do any of the things I normally do, which I would normally check the weather and make sure that you know, there's no high wind warnings because the canyon is so volatile. Trees can still come down, and trees at that time were coming down regularly. Like every time I hiked in, I'd have five or six more trees that I had to climb up and over just to get to my cabin. I just was like, oh, no problem. Bluebird day. I got this. Just, you know, had everything in my car. I didn't even go home. I just hiked in. I didn't have any of my essentials. I didn't have an InReach. I didn't have a canyon radio. Like, I had nothing. You know, I had my keys. So I hiked in, dropped all this stuff off. When I come in, I always, you know, have something to drink and a snack and whatnot. And I was here about 10 minutes, and all of a sudden, I just heard this howling. And I heard all of this acorns just, you know, stuff like falling on the roof of my cabin. And I was just like, oh, this is a really, really bad sound. And now this is within the first year after the fires. So this is even before we had these rains. So the fire, because it was slow moving, it was actually going underground and it was burning the roots of the trees. So while the trees were standing and they looked green, the roots themselves actually were not stable. So that's why the trees were falling for no reason. Like, you didn't need wind for the trees to fall. They were just falling because the stability of the root systems and all of that drought, they were just dying from the underneath.
They're just slowly falling over till they hit that tipping point.
Yes, and then they were down. So I'm like, oh God, I have to get out of here. So I immediately locked the cabin up and I'm hiking down. And I'm, you know, Winter Creek, it's a narrow, you know, you're in a canyon, you're in a low point, and there's a ridge line on either side. Jason, I am probably 7 minutes from the cabin. And at the time when we hiked in today, all of those alders are gone. But this was all along the creek. It was just this grove of alders, and they were really unstable. And I was about 7 minutes from the cabin. And now, mind you, the wind is blowing from behind me, and it is a howling wind, not just like a whoosh, but like whoosh, where you could feel the push of the wind. You could feel the debris kicking up off the ground. And, you know, like, I was just like, oh God, I'm in a really bad situation right now. I got to get out of here. Hiking. All of a sudden, I'm in this grove and I can see these trees waving back and forth. And there had to have been 60, 70 alder trees. And they're just bending and going back and forth. And all of a sudden, I start hearing this sound that I had never heard before. But I knew exactly what it was when I heard it. I heard a tree stressing beyond the point of it being able to hold itself up. And I heard what sounded like an old creaky ship where the wood was being stressed. And I heard this tree snap, bend, and break. And I turned around me, and the wind is blowing in my face at this point, and I watched a giant 100-plus-foot alder fall down and take out three other trees with it. And this is about 50 feet from me. It bangs on the ground. The wind is still howling, like crazy howling wind. Because I turned to look, because I'm hearing a sound that is terrifying me, I see this tree fall, takes down these other trees, and now debris is in my eyes. And I'm literally like trying to get the debris out of my eyes. I can't move because I don't want to take a misstep. I can't see, but I still am like, oh God, I got to clear my eyes up. As my eyes are closed and I'm just trying to blink the debris out of my eyes, I hear what sounds like a giant animal running towards me. And I'm like, oh my God, what on earth is running towards me? I open my eyes just in the nick of time to see this huge buck with a full rack of antlers.
So it was sincerely an animal.
It was sincerely an animal that was where those trees had fallen, and it was doing the same thing I was doing, just trying to get the heck out of there. I mean, this was just the most gorgeous animal I'd ever seen. And for where I was on the side of the trail, I was up on this narrow upper portion. The creek was below me and it was running straight towards me because it's the only trail portion that was there. And as soon as it saw me, and you know, at this point I turned my back to sort of the wall of the canyon, you know, because I'm like, oh my God, this thing's running straight at me. It's also in a panic mode. It sees me, you know, I could see it like, oh God, there's a human. And so then it dips down and it goes, and I'm watching it run across the creek. The wind is still blowing, and all of a sudden I hear that same sound of that stressed wood, and I hear much closer than this one tree that took out these other three trees, and I look, and there's an old oak, which aren't they're really rigid. They don't sway the way the alders do, and it cracks and breaks, and this tree was literally 15 feet from me, and it snaps and it breaks away from me, and I am just like, oh my God, Houston, we have a problem. I got to get out of here. So thankfully, that was the worst of it. I moved as quickly. I mean, that 50-minute hike was about a 25-minute hike. I just hauled it out of there. And I laugh now because I made every mistake in the book. I had no essentials with me. I had no InReach. I had no Canyon radio. Nobody knew where I was. So essentially, if one of those trees had fallen in the wrong direction, it would have fallen on me and no one would have known I was there. This story is actually a story I teach my students about preparedness, because in all of my years of being an outdoor educator, I didn't do any of the things I specifically remind people to do about preparedness, your 10 essentials, letting someone know what your trip plan is. So in case there is some unforeseen circumstance, if you don't call them or text them by that designated time, at least someone knows where you should be and they can then be that point of contact to get a search and rescue for you. It was just such a good reminder. It reminded me, like, Pamela, practice what you preach. It was really quite a hair-raising experience.
I mean, the reason to carry all those items is so that you don't need them, because when you don't have them is when things happen.
Yeah.
So if you want to keep the things away, carry them so you'll never have to use
exactly.
them.
Exactly. If I had my 10 essentials, but also when I got home, had I looked at the weather, even though it was at noon, it was a bluebird day and it was still, mm-hmm. had I looked at the weather, had I just looked at my basic weather app, even just, you know, your iPhone app that mm-hmm. just shows the weather, it already showed there were technically gale force winds. Mm-hmm. They were telling truck drivers not to drive on the inner highways through the range because the winds were so strong it would have blown the trucks over. So that was technically gale force winds. And had I just done even the simplest thing of like, well, let me just do a quick weather check, which would have taken me a couple minutes, I would never have come into the canyon that day with just that one simple
right.
step, because I'd have been like, yeah, no, that's the dumbest thing ever.
But now you've gotten to see that beautiful book and you've gotten experienced.
Yeah, I have a hair-raising story. And
you know,
it does make me think about Alden's like snow story in the woods, trapped in the snow. I'm like, God, you know, what we do and what we survive is sort of the laughable best story that you have.
That's right. Terrible things are supposed to happen so that we can enjoy them later.
Yes, exactly. And you know, it's a lesson learned, and it will certainly remind me always to do the minimal.
So one of the things, I'm going to transition us away from the cabin talk and this area talk now. One of the things that you mentioned early on is you referred to yourself as a llama mama.
Yes.
And I do know that Leah the llama.
Leah the llama.
Leah the mm-hmm. llama. You have other llamas, Lisa?
I have Leah, Jamie, CJ.
So yes.
Mocha. And then Santiago and Cole.
So quite a number of llamas. I know this has been a thing in your life for the last few years.
It has been
a thing. So you need to explain to us this llama mama situation.
The secret, I'm just telling you, manifestation. So the llamas were also something I totally manifested. There was a time when I would be backpacking, you know, and I would always joke around, you know, oh, if I had llamas, we could have luxury items. We could have a cast iron skillet when we are backpacking and, you know, fishing by this lake, so our fish would taste even better. And I would just start manifesting all of, you know, the silly talk, and I would actually Photoshop llamas into some of the back, into the background of some of our silly photos. And so I was always on this manifestation of like, someday I'm going to get llamas because I love the outdoors enough to also know that my body may not physically always be able to carry a 30 plus pound backpack. Then I'll have my backcountry RVs and they can carry all my luxury items. And, you know, then I can just carry my water and, you know, my snacks and they can do all the heavy lifting. It was actually with Shantae Salibert who, you know,
previous
has been
on, guest on the show.
Yeah, previous guest on the show, also part of our roundtable with Alden. She and I were hiking along a portion of the Pacific Crest Trail, because at the time she was working on her guidebook, and it was during this specific Southern California leg where I was really just manifesting the llamas, because we were carrying like almost 20 pounds of water and it was a really dry portion. I was like, God, if I had my llamas, they could carry all that stuff for us. And you know, and so then my trail name became Pamela Llama. And you know, then just because you have so much time talking on the trail, I was like, my llamas will live at Pamela Llama Land, and I'll knit socks for everyone for Christmas, and I'll give them beanies, you know. And it just became this ridiculous, because you have so much trail time, you just start, you know, doing kind of silly things. And then that following Christmas, one of my oldest friends, as far as distance of time that we've known each other since we were young kids, reached out to me. It was the day after Christmas, and he texts me and he says, hey, you know, I know we don't do gifts or anything, he says, but I have a llama for you. And I was, and because of our unique, beautiful, wonderful, long-term friendship, I totally knew he wasn't playing a joke on me. I knew he was totally serious. I texted him back and I said, you know, I'd love the llama. You know, I've talked about llamas for quite some time.
And he was like, oh, really? I hadn't noticed.
Yes, exactly. And so I said, it's a tentative yes, but I don't know anything about llamas and I don't know what their care is and I don't really know what the requirements are. And so I need to at least have about an 8 to 10 week window to be able to figure this out, to find out if it makes sense in my world and in my life. And if it makes sense, you know, I'm like, oh my God, yes, but wait, you know, hold on. I know it's not a living room pet. So, you know, I had to kind of figure it out. Like, this is what I mean by manifestation. Again, I'm going to get all like, woo, but
hold on, let me place some crystals around.
Yes,
this.
Exactly.
All right,
we're placing crystals and, you know, the whole thing.
Make a salt circle.
A salt circle, the whole bit. But honestly, I'd been talking about this. It was something I was dead set in that my future self, I was going to get llamas. Like, I was dead set in my older years that I was going to have a little ranch. I was going to have llamas. And the llamas literally were going to be pack animals for not just me, but for friends that maybe were only day hikers. But then it would now allow them to backpack because they couldn't maybe carry their pack. So I already knew, like, this was on my vision board. I'd talked about it. Like, I had dates set. You know, I was like, it's going to happen by this time. It happened sooner. So, but with that, because I had kind of manifested this, and again, woo, you know, yeah, very hippy dippy or whatever. But I truly believe in, like, that you really can kind of bring those things into your world that you really, really want just by focusing on it and by talking about it and joking about it. I really think that conversation put it out there. A couple days later, I'd reached out to all my backpacking friends just saying, hey, it's possible I might be getting my llama sooner, and I just want to know if anyone out there has any knowledge or anything about this type of animal so I can have a conversation, I can learn, and I could figure out everything I need to know, essentially, you know, like, hello, Llama 101, essentially, you know, Cliff Notes, and, you know, the quick version.
I would say, I bet this is exactly like when I was like 7 or 8 years old, and I got a pet hamster, so I bought the How to Care for a Hamster book and read that.
Yes, it's exactly, exactly, you knew what to do. The very next day, a friend of mine who I backpack with was like, oh, two of my best friends from college, their parents actually have a ranch and they breed llamas, and they're out in Riverside, which was like an hour from me. Here's their phone number. They're expecting a phone call from you. So I called them. We had a quickish conversation. They said, if you're really serious, come over this weekend and we'll sit down and we'll have a very real conversation with you about everything you need to know. And we'll really get you up to speed on what it takes, what the requirements are, the temperament, the disposition of this animal, like really what the care is and what you need to know. And I was like, done. And then a couple days later, I was just still, you know, I was still like, okay, I'm going to have that conversation with them. I'm still trying to work out the logistics. At the time, I'm like, I don't have ranch land. Like, where can I keep this animal in, you know, the greater Los Angeles County area? I just started putting it out there again. And then I remembered, I was like, oh, Chantry Flats, they have the pack station. Let me call the pack station and see if maybe there's space for me to have the llamas up here, you know, or the llama at the time up here.
The singular llama.
The singular llama. The owner of the pack station, Deb, she picked up the phone. She never picks up the phone. So you have to understand, it always goes to voicemail. She picks up the phone, and I was really surprised. I was just going to leave this very long-winded, hyper, super enthusiastic, hey, I'm a great person, want to know if there's space for this llama that I haven't quite yet committed to.
You weren't supposed to answer the phone, Deb. I don't know what to say now.
Yeah, so she says, well, come on over. When can you be there? And I'm like, I'm 20 minutes from you. I will see you in 20 minutes. I hung up the phone, drove up to Chantry. When I got here, we had a really beautiful conversation. And she said, you know, I was looking at my permits, and I actually have permits to the other pack station up here, the old ranger station that the rangers used to use when they used to ride horseback on all the trails. And that's how they wouldn't go on foot. They would go on horse when they would do their routes and, you know, make sure everything was okay. Like, that's how they would patrol. They would do everything on horseback. She said, I have the permits with my permit through the Forestry Service, the land lease for this other completely separate facility from where my donkeys are. It's right up the hill here. Let's go take a look at it. And she says, it's yours. You could use it. We went up there and there, you know, because it hadn't been used in 20 years. The barn needed a lot of work. Everything up here needs restoration. The barn needed restoration, but there was a tack room. There was a barn for the animals. There was this big, beautiful space that had 5-foot fencing with barbed wire for, you know, wild cats and things like that. The only thing was, is the grass was, you know, as tall as me in that area. So it was going to take a little bit of work. But she's like, you have access to this. I will, you know, you can use the, you can just piggyback on the permit that I have. And that is essentially how I ended up with the llamas, because every door just sort of opened. And that was really how my llamas ended up coming up to Chantry Flats.
Llamas are something you're planning on for a while, but there are other pack animal options. Why not a donkey, or why not horses? Why specifically llamas? What was the draw to the llama?
The draw to the llama for me is as someone who really is about leaving as little impact as possible on the environment. Llamas are ruminants, which means they have more than one stomach, so they're like a goat or a cow. So if they're chewing up on an invasive grass here in their home area, and I take them up into the Sierras 500 miles north, when they go to eliminate, because they've digested their food multiple times, what you end up with, the end byproduct, are what look like little jelly beans. They're called llama beans. And so they're there's essentially no seed or byproduct of what they've eaten that could then start infesting and causing invasive grasses to spread in other areas. So that was one, is that I knew that from an environmentally, I knew that, you know, we have all these grasses here. I knew that it wasn't going to go anywhere else.
I'm going to call that the fact of this episode.
The fact of this episode.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about this, about the digestion process of llamas.
Yes, and they're actually, just so you know, if you guys grow your own gardens, like, llama beans are the best fertilizers, hands down, just so you know.
Erica's going to have to ask you if she can get some llama beans before we go.
Yes, absolutely. Two is they have soft pads on their feet like a dog, and they're two-toed, so they have toenails and these soft pads, and they're really agile like a mountain goat. So they're not hooved, but they have soft pads, which means their footprint as well, they're not as heavy-footed as a shoed donkey, horse, or mule. So even from that perspective, they don't leave as much of an impact damage to the trails that you can do. And also, they're more agile. So, you know, they can jump over logs. And I've had it where we have been packing and there were downed trees, and I just took their saddlebags off and took the weight off of them, and they leaped over those downed trees like a gazelle. A donkey, mule, or horse cannot do that. You know, you can take them places. You know, they're more sure-footed, and, you know, you can get them around in uneven areas on the trail if you come across something that is going to stop another type of pack animal. And then, I mean, come on, they're just llamas, you know? Like, they're llamas.
All right, so reportedly llamas can be pretty mean, spit, and they've got big sharp teeth. What are your response to that? Is that accurate? Have you,
so they actually
they have angry
very
dispositions?
Few teeth. So llamas actually have no upper teeth, only in the back, only in their incisors to chew, and then they only have their bottom teeth. But they do have sharp teeth. They do have what's called their fighting teeth, and they are hooked. And they grow in at about 3 years of age. And that's so in the wild when they fight, like, it's really more male dominant. So that way the hierarchy of the male, if some young juvenile llama wants to come up and, you know, kind of challenge his herd, they essentially will go after the jugular or try to bite the balls off of the other animal so they can't breed their ladies. So yeah, so you file those down. just so you know, you file those down.
Every man with testicles was just relieved.
Exactly. So you file those down, and then I honestly have gelded animals. Like, I don't ever plan on breeding.
So you just took care of it for them.
I took care of it for them. You know, thanks to the vet, and it was a very simple, quick process, mm-hmm. pretty pain free. I pick my animals based on their personality and based on their temperament and disposition and based on where they are with the rest of the herd. I would never blindly just get an animal. I always go and work with and handle and just see. And then I work with the breeders and say, so these are the temperament of my other animals. And they will literally say, I've got these three animals or these two animals, or I've got five animals that you can choose from that I think would fit well with your herd. You know, I don't want to disrupt stuff. I want to make sure that, you know, the head of the herd isn't going to be challenged by another really dominant male or female. I mean, there's always going to be some of that happening, but I want it to be just a simple transition. So yeah, and then you always separate the boys from the girls. You don't, you know, they're not together. Even if a male's gelded, you know, the boys still want to have fun. So, you know, we keep the two together. Just, you know, the girls, you know, don't always want to have that fun. So
let's talk about the experience of having llamas. What are the responsibilities like? What does it look like to have a bunch of llamas over here at Chantry Flats?
So they're no longer at Chantry. So we were, you know, evacuated, which actually turned out to be a better. We have more space now. we have a larger piece of land that they're on in a private setting versus in this public access setting. It's just different. We're still right against the, you know, background of the Angeles National Forest. So, you know, we do have trail access all the time. They're closer to me. So the responsibilities is essentially feeding, cleaning. You know, it's summertime now, so they did all get their haircuts. So yes, I do card their wool, and yes, I am spinning, and yes, I am weaving and knitting and felting. So I that part of my manifestation did happen.
So you kept true to that.
You're I kept people true to that as well. Socks. Not hats. They're getting, yes, I'm working on that. I'm working up to those skills. But essentially, it's just like any other large livestock animal. You know, I do most of their care. I have an amazing vet, and I just love her, and I'm so grateful I found her. And she's, you know, she has that idea of wanting you to know more or as much as you can know. So if there's an emergency, you're aware of what to do, especially because I take them out on the trail. So if something is going to go wrong, we're not going to have access. You know, we will be someplace where I need to know how to handle certain settings or certain situations. And they're incredible. They're pretty low maintenance animals for livestock. Their nails, you know, they, when they're active and young, they kind of file themselves down like emery boards, you know, when they're hiking. So I don't need to do any nail trims. Their teeth, they don't, you know, just through eating, they don't really, they're not like a horse where their teeth need to be floated. Really the biggest thing is shearing them annually and just making sure that their weight is good. And then just, you know, feeding them their minerals and foods and things like that, that they need to stay healthy.
And then when you take them out on trails, what does that look like? Sounds like you throw some saddlebags on them, you throw some things in their saddlebags, and clearly you can't take them on all trails, only on trails that allow pack animals, correct?
So far, you can take them on all trails.
Oh, really?
I want to preface that by, I won't take them someplace I haven't myself gone or haven't done a ton of research to know that it's the right place for them. Again, because I don't want to get us in a situation. I want to make sure, you know, like this year, I'm doing some trips at the end of the summer up in the Sierras. I was making very sure that I didn't have to do any heavy creek crossings because we've had such a snow impact. And then we had a heat wave and a lot of that snow has melted. So our creeks are really, really...
You don't want to wash away.
Yeah, I don't want to wash away my animals. You know, I want to make sure everyone's safe. But yeah, so essentially I do a lot of research. It's talking to the rangers. You know, when you go to get your hiking permit up in the Sierras, there's literally a box that says, you know, pack animals, check it, yes, what kind, and you tell them. And then the ranger kind of has a bigger conversation with you. But I always, you know, start that conversation off with them by just saying, hey, this is the research I've done. I'm planning on stopping at these places for grazing. Do I have to worry about any areas of restoration where animals can't graze now? You know, but they're welcome on any trails, you know, most any trails.
And speaking of the grazing, do they typically graze while they're on trail with you, or do you have to bring additional food? I'm assuming you must bring something, right?
I do bring supplemental food, but I do let them graze. It's really good for them. I will bring a pound of alfalfa pellets a day for each animal. Sometimes I'll actually bring actual grass for them. It all just depends. And, you know, I might sprinkle that in. But if they're grazing grassland and then they've got that alfalfa, the alfalfa pellets as that sort of fill, you know, because I'll rehydrate that with water and it expands about four times the amount. It's actually enough for them.
Does it limit what campsites you can use? Can you still camp and dispersed camping? Or
I
you
can
have
still
to go?
Do dispersed camping. I'm very, very mindful if I'm someplace that is pack specific, where I will use pack animal sites, even though I don't technically need to. I still do because I want to be mindful to other backpackers too, you know, because they are going to eliminate, they are going to do things like that. So I do want to be mindful, like, hey, if, you know, there are other pack animals out on the trail, like, let's just kind of keep all of that to some areas. So I am very careful on where, you know, I mean, it requires more planning. It's more work, honestly, than if I were to just spontaneously go, hey, let me just grab a pack and grab the dog and just go. It's a little more work, but it's a lot more fun. It's just such a weird, it's a weird thing. It's a lot more fun.
What does it look like when you're at camp with them? If you had horses, right, you either have to put them in a corral or you've got to tie them off or you've got to do something. Is that the same?
Same thing with a llama. Yeah. So like here, for example, when I bring them up here, I will tie them from this big oak to that oak and I'll have carabiners and looped and I'll do it high. I'll string them up high. So that way their leads are going up so they can't trip over their leads. And then they'll just have like they're each zone of circle kind of the zone of depending on how long the lead line is, anywhere from 15 to 30 feet, depending on how long I'll let the lead line be. And then they have that kind of that zone of rotation so they can go to the bathroom, drink their water and eat. And they'll just, you know, sit and sleep attached to that lead line. And then I can also, you know, attach them to rocks and things like that. But I prefer to have their lead line up. Because when they do start to get, you know, when they feel the lead around their feet, they will panic. And, you know, then that can be a whole other ridiculous kind of, you guys, you seriously aren't doing this. You know? Like, come on.
When did you get the, what year did you get the first llama? Or roughly?
2006. 16, I think. 15 or 16.
Okay, so eight or nine years, somewhere around there. Yeah. So nearly a decade.
Yeah, nearly a decade, yeah.
How often are you getting out with them on trail?
Well, I take them out on trail twice a week. So that's just getting them hiking.
Like every week?
Every week. You know, they're pack animals, and while they do run and play and all of that, like, I still want to make sure that they're well-behaved, that they're trained. It's like training a dog. You know, I want to make sure that they know where to be, that they know commands, and my llamas have the same commands as my dogs, so everyone's responding at the same time. I'm not like doing two different commands trying to get the same reaction out of my animals. Yeah, so they just, you know, like I'll say wait instead of whoa. Like, you know, most people will be like, whoa, like you would a horse. I'm like, wait. As soon as I say wait, they stop. You know, when I say, okay, let's go, you know, the dog will go, the llamas will go. So yeah, it's just working with them, you know, knowing where they should be, even amongst themselves, you know, where they're kind of hierarchy and pack order. And it's just good exercise, and it's fun, and it's sort of bonding, and it's, I love it.
Clearly, you've had a lot of experiences with them. If in like 8 years, you're taking them out twice a week. Granted, you started with only one, and now you have eight,
well,
ten? How many?
No, I actually, so I was very fortunate in a weird sense that the first llamas that I got, they were already older, which was good, rather than getting like a 2 or 4 year old and going, wow, I have a 30 year lifespan with this animal. Leia was older. She was already a teenager. And then through my Llama Jedi Masters, I bought, they were little, like you can't have a single llama. You have to have at least two. So I ended up taking three from them.
Rapidly.
Yeah. So yeah, very quickly. They're herd animals. So you can't ever have just one. And that was part of our big sit down conversation. This isn't a pet. You can't just have one. They're herd animals. They need each other. So I did end up getting, like, immediately just having quite a few. They passed away within the first 4 years. They all senioured out and passed away. Then I brought Santiago and Mocha home, and I still had Jamie. And Jamie passed away just in December at 26. When I brought Mocha and Santiago home after Leia had passed away, she was 21 when she passed away, we had a mountain lion attack, and the mountain lion killed Mocha and attacked Santiago. And Jamie was unharmed. So, and I had had them for only 3 months. So now I have a llama that was attacked and totally spooked, and that I'm working, that it doesn't even know me very well yet. I have a senior animal that knows me really, really well. So now I'm working with a young animal, you know, and I have an old animal. So I already knew that I needed to get another young animal because I bought that young team. So when my senior, most senior boy, he was at time 22, I knew like their life expectancy is about generally about 20, but I take such good care of my animals that I was literally making sure they had a senior diet and keeping their weight on and getting the appropriate exercise for their age and where they were. And I was working with my vet, you know, I was like, you guys are going to have the best senior years ever. So Jamie ended up living to be 26. And then I ended up bringing Cole home. But my relationship with Santiago is really, really unique because he survived a mountain lion attack. I survived that mountain lion attack with him. We were both stressed, and it was just this really emotional connection that I had with him. And so I have such a unique bond with him. Like, he literally will come up to me, use his neck to like hug me and put his head on my shoulders. And he really sees me, because first, any little thing that would move, he would take off and run. You know, like I'd have a lead on him, and, you know, we'd be hiking, and he would get spooked almost immediately. And I was like, okay, you just have to know to trust me. So it took several months of just knowing, like, hey, you have to trust me. Like, I'm your person. I got you. I'm here. So, you know, when I'd see coyotes on the trail, you know, like he would just get immediately and hide behind me, and I'd just start yelling at the coyotes. I'd throw rocks at them and they'd move away. And then he learned, like, okay, she's got me. Like, I am safe with her. And we have such a unique bond now. Anytime he's not sure, like if there's a mountain biker or there's an unleashed dog, bad, running towards us, bad, you know, he knows, like he'll just stand behind me and he knows I've got it. It's a very, very unique situation because I got him when he was younger. He went through this huge trauma. We went through that trauma together, and we healed together in a very unique way because I really needed him, because I was heartbroken. He was heartbroken because it was his bonded pair that had gotten killed. That was a big thing for us.
So were you present during this attack?
No, I wasn't present at all. I wasn't present. But, you know, you get here and you see...
Right, you see the aftermath.
You see the aftermath. Right. And, you know, then, of course, then I see Santiago, and his face was... his cheek was ripped open.
Oh, man.
So what we think happened is when Mocha got killed and dragged, we think because Santiago was very protective, we think that Santiago went you know, ran hearing Mocha scream. And then we think the cat defended its kill and like lashed out and like slashed at Santiago's face. And then Jamie being such a senior animal, and he was such a good guard animal. Another reason you have llamas is for guard animals. They're good for sheep, goats, and smaller herd animals. And so they'll do calls and warning calls if there are animals in the area, predatorial animals. And so he's a great guard. So I think because of all of his years, he just knew to sit still, do not move. I move, this animal cause a flight. So he was unharmed. And then, so that night, because I hadn't had a place to move them yet, like I was just like, oh my God, mountain lion's going to come back, because that's what they do. They come back and finish their kill. They don't drag the kill away. The mountain lion had dragged Mocha into the barn. So now I couldn't put him in the barn at night because that cat was there. My vet had come up. You know, she was with me. She helped sew Santiago back and removed Mocha for me. And I was very grateful for that. And I ended up camping with the llamas that night because I was like, the cat is coming back. Like, I have to be here because that cat is going to come back. And it's going to come back because it's going to finish its kill. It knows where it's left it. Sure enough, that night, you know, I had as many lanterns as I could borrow from friends. I literally was just like, 911, I need all of your camping lanterns, preferably battery versus, you know, like a flame. But I just had, you know, so I had lanterns throughout the corral area. I had my tent. The llamas are nocturnal, so they're up at night. Sure enough, at about 10 o'clock at night, I hear Jamie doing his cackle. And I have a big mag light, a big light, and I flash that light, and sure enough, I see these eyes peering back at me, and I see a smaller second set of eyes. So it was a mother with her cub. Oh. And they literally were there for about an hour, and I had a cowbell, and I was ringing the bell, and I was screaming and yelling, and I just watched them for about an hour move about 100 feet away, and because I had the light, it was reflecting their eyes back at me. And then, you know, after about an hour or so, they kind of went off where my light was no longer reflecting on them, you know, but then I'm like moving around, and I'm making all this noise and, you know, trying to make sure. And then the 911 emergency at that point goes away. And then at about 1 o'clock, Jamie does his alert call again. And sure enough, they're back, you know, and then I'm up again ringing the cowbells. And, you know, I've got lanterns, so there was no dark spots. You know, I had all the corners essentially of the corral area. There was no like dark corner where they could jump the fence and come into. Everything was illuminated as best as it could be. And I did this for a couple nights until I found the safe place where I could move them. So it took me two nights of camping out with my animals, making sure that the cat didn't come back.
All right. How stressful were those two nights?
Oh, it was awful. I didn't sleep. It was awful. I'm heartbroken. Yeah. You know, I saw, you know, I mean, really National Geographic's just very, you know, traditional mountain lion kill. I totally understand that we're in a natural environment, and I understand it's, you know, it was easy for them. It was the cats, you know, this was right after the closure. So this is after the pandemic closure. So there were no more people in the area. So the wildlife was creeping in further. So it's part of it. Like, it just broke my heart. It was awful. I will never allow that to happen again. You know what I mean? Like, now my animals are in a setting where they go in the barn at night. They come out in the morning. Like, they're never going to be exposed to that. Mm-hmm. This was a three-sided barn. So they had protection from the elements, but they didn't have, you know, it wasn't where they had protection from things like that. I don't wish that upon anybody.
But I've got to just imagine, like, you're getting these two conflicting emotions while you're dealing with this. Just your innate fear of a mountain lion, especially at night in the dark. They could be terrifying. But then also that instinct to protect your animals. And those things are just butting heads.
Oh, it was
all night long.
It was all about, like, at this point, you know, cats, they're still fearful. I was loud, noisy. I created an environment where the cat isn't going to come into because it didn't have a way to hide and come in. You know, my animals at this point, they were calm because I was there. Like, they were sitting. It wasn't like when the cat was there and when Jamie did his cackle, you know, his call, his warning cry, you know, they didn't suddenly get up and, you know, they were just sitting like, okay, we know we need to be still. We know that if we move, the cat's going to move. So I was the only one that was really being big and screaming and yelling. And, you know, the llamas now are feeling a little safer because I'm there, I would assume, I would imagine. Yeah, no, it was awful. it was, you know, again, a chapter in a book. You know, emotionally, adrenaline, you know, part of it, I was also just, there was part of me too, as someone who just loves and has this fascination, beauty of nature, to be able to know that the cat was going to come back. Like, I knew the behavior of the cat. I knew the cat was going to come back that night because it's how mountain lions work. If you see an animal killed, they're going to come back. That's, you know, we're not in the Serengeti where they're going to climb it up in a tree because there's other animals, you know, like they're going to, they'll come, they'll just leave it where it is. They might drag it a little bit, you know, and who knows, maybe the cat would have taken Mocha somewhere else that night. It was beautiful in a way that, like, oh my God, there's the mountain lion. Whoa. Mm. Oh, it has a cub. Like, there was part of me, you know, yes, it was protective of my animals. And yes, oh my God, all of me was just like hurting from that experience because it was just, it's such a brutal way for an animal that you love so much and you care so much and you bring it into your fold to protect it for an animal to go because it's not, it's slow. It's a slow death. You're being eaten alive, essentially. But that other part of me was just so fascinated by, like, this beauty of this mother and this cub. Mm. And, you know, I saw them again in the morning. Like, they were trying to get, there was a gap to the barn of about a, probably 8 inches. And it was, you know, it was around seeing if it couldn't get under that gap and go in there because it hadn't, it didn't realize I had removed, you know, Mocha. Cats also, they're not going to come back during the day. I knew that they were going to come back at dawn and dusk and somewhere in the middle of the night. So I knew during the day my animals were fine, but I also knew at night was where I really had to be on high alert with them.
Yeah. And I mean, and those cats are thinking, we know there's food in there, and based on, you know, whatever sort of plan they've created, okay, this is dinner. Wait, we don't get fed tonight? Okay, we're coming back. Oh, we don't get fed tonight either. So they feel like they're running out of opportunities, I would imagine. They get desperate.
Yeah.
And so they realize they've got to move on and look for opportunities elsewhere.
Because a healthy mountain lion has to eat one deer a week to stay healthy. And Mocha was a small deer, you know, and she had her cub offspring. So obviously she's thinking of her cub as well. So, yeah, it's very interesting.
So, despite these traumatizing experiences that you've gotten to have with your pack animals, why don't we finish off this conversation about the llamas with the opposite and the positive, enjoyable experiences you've had with these llamas?
So what I love most about llamas, and was probably, thank you for transitioning. It was a really good transition. The beauty about llamas, and this was a lot of my attraction to them, they're like the unicorn of trail animals, right? Anytime we're on the trail, when someone sees us on the trail, I just see this spark in that person's eye. I see the delight of, oh my gosh, is that a llama? I have a beautiful conversation with them. I can educate them a little bit about how special these animals are, you know, kind of like we had, like, you know, the ruminant, the, you know, why I have them as pack animals, the more environmental, things like that. And it's just such a beautiful exchange for people because they're an uncommon animal to see on the trails.
Oh, uncommon animal to see.
Yeah, period. To see. Yeah. So it's a really beautiful experience. And that's the one thing, when I have them with me when I'm hiking, I'm already in that mindset of, like, I already know anytime I come across someone, I'm going to spend 5 or 7 or 10 minutes just enjoying an exchange with them. It's just, it's part of that headspace that I get into. Like, I'm never with them when I just need to do a quick hike. Like, they don't come with me. You know, that's when I'm doing it with just the dogs. Like, okay, I'm just out here for a quick hike and kind of just, you know, being in my own headspace. Like, when I'm with the llamas, it really is this sort of, like, you know, okay, I can come across mountain bikers. I can educate them on the best way to be on the trail with pack animals. Let me know when you're behind me. Say, hey, rider up. You know, so it really is a beautiful educational experience when I have them in the front country trails. And for those of you who are listening, front country, I would just say, is anything with that local range of mountains. Back country, I'd say, is really those big mountains like the Sierras, you know, the Rockies, anything where you are really going deep, deep, deep several days in. That's back country versus front country. In front country, you get people that come in and out very quickly that may not be as educated. Most people who go into the back country, they really have a different set of skills because they know they're going 2, 3, 4 days a week, a month, you know, not seeing anybody. And so that's a different skill set and a different set of knowledge. So, you know, when I'm in the front country, I already know it is about education, and it's what I love. Like, I love to teach, because why teaching is so important to me is because my passion for the outdoors was from the time that someone who is where I am now taught me. You know, they gave me those bits of education. They told me, hey, that banana peel actually is litter. Or, hey, you don't want to cut switchbacks. This is the reason why you're pre-eroding trails. Trails are designed for water runoff. So when you cut that switchback, well, yeah, you can see that other half of the trail right there. You're doing damage to the trail, and you're preventing the trail design for doing what it is. So it was all of that language from people that had not only the knowledge, but the beauty and the passion to just say, hey, I want to educate you. You may not react well, but you may. You know, so I kind of take that same approach to it too. I've learned a language now when I talk to people. It's not a disciplinary. It's right. a, did you know? And I even do that more importantly with people and their dogs. You know, I'm a dog owner and God, I know what it's like to see your dog just run on a trail. I also know that not every trail dogs are allowed to be that. And in our front country trails where we are, it's a leash law. You're in LA County. Like we're in LA County, there's a leash law. And so I always have to, I approach that running dog. You know, when someone says, hey, that dog is friendly. That doesn't matter. If I'm with my animals, they see that dog as running prey, a predatory right, running towards right. them. And so I have learned, instead of saying your dog should be leashed, well, that puts that person on the defensive. Mm-hmm. Well, my animal's friendly. That's never a positive interaction. Right. But I've learned if I make it about the safety of their animal, about the safety of their animal, just as much as about the safety of my animals, whether it's my dog, my llamas, if I make it about their animal's safety, hey, you're going to scare my animals and your dog could be kicked and killed. Then you see the human hustle a little bit more when I really focus on the safety of them, of mm-hmm. their animal, and make it about them. You know, it's equally about both animals, you know, because my animals can, if they really wanted to, they could knock me off my feet and drag me. They just know they don't need to, because they've been trained and handled well enough to see me as that lead of their pack. You know, so I've always learned to just approach these things of education and, you know, just, hey, it's okay. You know, just want you to know that this is how animals are perceived. And even my dogs, when they're on a leash, like that running animal towards them is still perceived. I don't care how friendly your dogs are. There's leash laws for a reason. If you want your dog to be free, find a trail where that's okay. Go to a dog park where that's okay. There's just bigger conversations.
I think there's a good point there too, because I think a lot of people think the leash laws are kind of frivolous, but they don't realize exactly what you're talking about. You might encounter something on the trail you don't expect to encounter, like yeah. a llama
mm-hmm.
or any number of other things,
or even a mountain biker.
And you might not be prepared for that.
Yeah, these yeah. are shared trails. So, I mean, I've seen dogs attack mountain bikers, because when you see each other all at once, everyone's slowing down and everyone's reacting very quickly, and the dog is startling, and the dog may not necessarily be aggressive, but if it feels threatened, it's going to act in a way to protect itself and protect its person.
Or it might do something weird and unexpected, yeah. which then yeah. knocks the person off yeah. the bike, or yeah. causes that person to do something, to run into a child.
Yeah.
So yeah. There's unexpected things that can
And then
occur.
Even from a wildlife perspective, and I think this is something that a lot of people don't think about too, if your dog is running along the trail and it sees a jackrabbit and it decides it wants to take off and run after that jackrabbit, it may not have gotten attacked and killed that jackrabbit. Like, it might have had 200 or 300 feet of just chasing this animal and going in full kind of, you know, predatory play, so to speak. But for that jackrabbit may have been trying to forage for food to survive for the next 12 hours of its life. And it might have used all of its resources to escape with its life for that dog. But now that jackrabbit or whatever other animal, small animal or even larger animal, you might have now used its entire resources and it still might not survive that encounter.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of just bigger pictures that this is all stuff I learned. So this is even, you know, like everything I know is just through wanting to know. Everything I learned is through educating myself. Everything I learned was through conversations with someone who knew more than me on the trail. And I think that's the beautiful thing about constantly teaching and having conversations and educating, and why I always try to approach it, you know, these conversations from a really beautiful perspective of, hey, it's not a shaming thing. It's just, let me just share let me just give you some things to think about and some thoughts and things like that. So if you come across, not me on the trail, or maybe another llama person on the trail, but, you know, or anyone who's kind of wanting to give you a different perspective on something, just stop for a second and just don't speak, and just listen and take that information. Don't try to tell me about your animal, or don't say, well, that's not my dog, or that's not, you know, just for a second, just listen. You might learn something. A lot of what I learned was from me just stopping and not speaking and being receptive to saying, this person might, you know, what you're saying right now, I know, but if I just stop for a second, you're going to tell me more than what I know, and I'm going to learn more, and I'm going to be better on the trail. I'm going to be a better steward to the land. I'm going to know all of these things, and I'm going to be able to share more and be able to just make other people allow them to have the best experiences too.
So before we transition to the end of the show, I want to hit up one more quick topic, which is time management. Because you've mentioned a number of things in this episode. You come out to this cabin 3 times a week. You take your llamas out 2x a week. But you also work as a guide and you have other life responsibilities. So let's talk a bit about how you balance all that and set aside all those times for all of those responsibilities.
So I essentially have a 12-month calendar on my wall, and I have everything calendared out for the areas where I know I need absolute support. Now, my goal is to come to the cabin to have one overnight a week and one day a week. That's not always possible. Sometimes it might just be that I have two single days a week, and it might just be quickly coming in. My excitement is when we hiked, and you had mentioned, you know, talking about the Legacy crew at the front end of our conversation. I mean, we are literally there like spitting distance, 500 feet from getting that trail to my cabin. So then those overnight trips can include my llamas. Those hikes in can include my llamas. So that sort of now
combine
them together. And it's also really good practice if they're going to be here overnight, you know, for my animals to be on a lead. So it's all of these things where it's just a constant evolution of training. It's sort of like when you have a dog, you know, when you walk it, when they're young, you're always asking them to sit at a light. You're always, you know, just always working with them. It's the same thing with these animals. It's just, you know, the more exposure to get these. So those things will come together. I do have a really, really good support system. So I already know when I'm going to be gone for different days. And, you know, support needs to come in for the llamas, most importantly, the dog, most importantly, the cabin. Once the canyon's opened, you know, I bought this cabin not just for me, but for my circle of friends who love the outdoors as well. So anyone who's already come in and spent a weekend with me and overnight with me and kind of know the opening and closing and the details of the cabin and, you know, the opening, you rake and sweep everything and, you know, just kind of the cabin chores, so to speak, and all of that, like, they don't need me here. They already know the routine. They can just come and, you know, so then that's another way that the cabin will just get more attention and things on it. So right now the closure is through October 1st. Maybe that closure will lift. Maybe they'll extend it. But once that closure lifts, then my friends who have been to my cabin are allowed to come to my cabin without me. Of course, it's more fun when we're here as a group, but I don't need to be here because they've already been here without me. And so then that kind of covers, you know, a little bit of time of not, you know, being absent for a month with the cabin.
All right. So now we're going to transition to that final question.
Uh-oh, the big final hurrah.
Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. So based on everything that we talked about today, what's that final thought you want to leave everybody with?
We have covered and talked about so much, but I noticed, you know, that now where I am in my life is really circling back to really preserving our natural spaces and protecting our wild spaces, learning as much as you can so you can be that best steward. And I talked about that a lot. And being open to conversations and being open to learning and just being open to discovering and being open to the challenges of your own fears in certain settings, because a lot of what I've learned was through leaping through circles of fear of things, you know, to get to this point to where it's not that I don't have fears with things I do, but I have the knowledge to back up the support that I know will help me push past something that might be fearful for me. Hence the mountain lion and, you know, Mocha being killed. I already knew through knowledge the behavior of that cat and what was going to happen. So it allowed me to be able to be present in that moment and that fear, to know that what the behavior that I was having, the behavior that I was doing, wasn't going to come in conflict with what that cat's natural instinct was going to do. So I would just say, take the time to learn. Be open to people wanting to have that conversation with you. When you're on the trail, be on trail time, slow down, talk to each other, learn, you know, about being a good steward, trail ethics, you know, learn all of that stuff so you can be the best version of yourself and learn from your mistakes and be okay with that. Mistakes are beautiful. Like, I've been humbled by a lot of my own stupid mistakes, and I can look back now and be like, oh, shake my head and just like, wow. Thankfully, I had a lot of grace for myself, or the person that saw me doing something stupid had a lot of grace with me, you know, and I'd say I try to give that grace back. God, I'm just so lucky that the people that saw me doing dumb things approached it from a gentle conversation. That is always what I think is something that's so important in whatever aspect you are in life, is to just remember to give grace. Remember to just really be gentle, because harshness isn't received with gentleness. Harshness is received with harshness. So I think that's my kind of final, I don't know. I'm a talker. Like, we could be here for a very long time.
I think there's plenty in there. I would even argue there are multiple final thoughts in there.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for hiking out with us, hanging out here, giving us the picnic earlier.
Oh my gosh, it was my pleasure. I wanted to, you know, you guys were doing the hike in and taking the time, and I just really wanted to, you know, have you guys enjoy the cabin.
So. All right, well, thanks for being on the show again, too.
Thank you for having me, Jason. I'm grateful.
And now it's the part of the show where I invite you all to go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this, episode 127 with Pamela Zulalian. There you're going to find photographs of her in action and links to all of the things we talked about in today's show. And a reminder, you can always scroll down wherever you're listening to this and look in the show notes. Find all those links there. Find the link to our website, link to our YouTube page. All the links you need are either in the show notes or on our website. And if you should like to get in touch with us here at the show, you can do that a number of ways. You can email us, jason@gogetoutside.com, or leave a voicemail or send a text to +1-818-925-0106. And as always, please go to your podcast purveyor of choice, subscribe, rate, review. Most importantly, share this show with someone who you think would enjoy it. Next time on the show, maybe. Hopefully come back in a couple of weeks for the final episode of Season 6. And in the meantime, keep an eye on the Go Get Outside podcast YouTube page. There will be new videos and more content posted there fairly regularly. So hopefully we'll be back in 2 more weeks. See you then. Woo!